Hi everyone, welcome to ABCs of Anesthesia. Now today I have with me Dr. Michelle. Michelle is one of our consultants at Western Health, and she's got some really amazing tips to get through the final exam, especially because she actually wasn't successful the first time, and a lot of things were new to her and weren't realized. And so she went through this whole journey of having to try and change the way she studied to get through. And I think that'll be really relevant for a lot of people here. Now, just a bit of introduction. So Michelle, she's a full-time staff anesthetist at Western Health. So completed her VATS training through the Eastern scheme with St. Vincent's Hospital and a big portion of time at Box Hill. Now, you said your training was a bit slower than a lot of your mates because you've had a baby at the end of basic training and took a year of maternity leave. And now you've got two children and spend most of your time trying to sleep. But I'd say you're also pretty renowned in our department because I think you've anesthetized our patient, I think like our first patient who was 300 kilos, I think twice now or three times. And so again, a really nice badge of honor. So welcome, Michelle. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me, Lahiru.
Hayes, why don't we just get cracking? So tell us about your background, your exam journey. Like what happened to you?
This takes me back to early 2018. I was a fourth year registrar, but because of my maternity leave, my training had been slightly rearranged. So I was doing my OPATs as a fourth year reg. So I guess I was a little bit off script. Mm-hmm. And I got through the written part and the med viva that existed at the time. And I was studying for the viva, and I got the sense that it did not come naturally to me. And I could tell that people felt that way because of the feedback I was getting. And I know people were trying to be kind. I'd get a lot of comments like, "That was okay," and then not much else.
Oh, no. That's so unsatisfying, isn't it? Like, I know you want to say something, but maybe you don't want to offend me. And
yes. And to make things a little bit trickier, I was at a hospital that doesn't normally have people sitting the second part exam at that time. So I was a little bit isolated from the rest of the group that I would see at the college viva nights and at the exam courses and things like that. So I was a little bit out on my own too. So it wasn't easy day to day to catch up with people and viva. I remember there was one night where I was working the evening with a consultant who I believe is now a final part examiner. And we did a viva, and I still remember it was like a pediatric tonsillectomy with a bleed. Mm-hmm. And we did the viva, and she just looked at me and said, "You are clinically so much better than this. Why aren't you saying that? Like, what are you saying?" And I remember thinking, I don't really know what to do about this. I think I do things well at work. Mm-hmm. I feel like people have clinical confidence in me. And she hit the nail on the head that I was underselling what I do. And I didn't know how to fix that. I hoped that making sound decisions and having good knowledge would be enough to get me through the viva, and it wasn't. So I, was unsuccessful at the viva, and based on the score I got, I performed really badly.
Okay. That's interesting because, you know, you're doing the job well, but it's like the questions they're asking and the style that you're answering isn't satisfactory for whatever reason. And I always come down to the point that I think the exam asks these questions that you could say a correct answer to that question, like, you know, a technically correct answer, like, how would you intubate this patient? And you could say with an endotracheal tube, but that's not the answer that they're looking for. So there's this other game on another level behind the script that you have to know. And I didn't know that game either, but I figured it out. I wouldn't say figured it out. I'd say I had enough help from lots of people who gave me that feedback. And I went, oh crap, I've really got to change the way I do this. But yeah, so that seems really a common thing that I hear, it seems like a very normal thing to have happened to a lot of people, and you were unlucky because you weren't in the space where you're getting the right feedback, you had some isolation, and you were doing things outside of the normal way, which I think made you at risk of this.
I do want to say I had some fantastic people step up and try to help me. One was a merit winner. And I think the problem with them trying to help me was that it was so natural to them. I don't think they could understand why I just couldn't do what they do. And I couldn't do it. I could feel it, but I couldn't fix it.
Yeah. So what was your recovery from that? How did you cope with it? This is probably the first thing you failed in your life. How did you deal with that, and how did you get back into everything?
I still remember being quite speechless after I'd found out I'd failed, and I was with my husband, and we got out of the Uber, and he actually burst into tears and was like, "It's not fair. You've worked so hard." And I don't think I gave myself permission to grieve that had happened for probably a day. I think I was just lost. So I kind of, I had a lot of support from my family, and I obviously had a small child at the time, so, they don't care. so I had, a necessary distraction to get over it. And I guess I just gave myself some time to grieve and go and get some fresh air and try to, take a break and enjoy life. People were supportive as well. And, it turns out when these things happen that you're not alone. There's a lot of people who come out of the woodwork and say, "I really struggled. I resat this. I had a lot going on when I sat the exam, and, I definitely underperformed." So there's a lot of solidarity too, I think, that isn't obvious at first. You feel very lonely.
I've just really recently probably discovered this, that whether something's good or bad, it's not sometimes not the point. Obviously, failing an exam is, really a real a dent in the normal pathway that you accept. But, when you have these struggles, it's a moment of connection. All these little things that happen when you face it head on and you share it with someone and people come out of the woodwork, like you said, it is a moment that you kind of bond with another person, and it can be a really good moment as well for having that. Before we go to what you then started doing, what do you wish people had told you that they didn't? You mentioned people being quite polite, and I know from my experience when I'm examining, I just don't know. I'm not an examiner, so I don't know if someone would have failed or not. All I can give is, I would have done this and this and this. But yeah, it feels like that thing where, that was okay. You just can't be as superlative with your compliments as you'd like to be. So yeah, what do you wish people had told you, or get the feedback you wish you had got?
One of my really good friends who was a first-year consultant by the time I sat the exam turned around to me and said, "I was actually really worried, but I didn't want to ruin your confidence." And I found that quite hard to take, because we have a great relationship and we're still really good friends. But I think that idea of how do I balance out constructive feedback, which possibly can be a bit negative, with maintaining someone's confidence, because I think confidence in the viver is really important as well. It's a difficult balance. So going back to your question, what do I wish people had said to me? I think things around getting to the point of what really matters, and perhaps a bit more guidance around, in each viver, what was the point that you wanted to hear? A little bit more guidance around the structure. I had, I know people share lots of structures about how to answer questions, but I wasn't using them, I don't think, in the way that they need to be used. And I only see that now. I didn't see that at all the first time I sat.
Yeah.
I also think there's some things that I did in the first sitting which I thought I had to do that I wish people had said, we're not interested in hearing that. You're actually just wasting time. Mm-hmm. But I think the bigger thing was like the sort of global issues-based approach that I think the exam is actually asking for, like that sort of bigger picture. I got, I think I went far too narrow in how I was approaching each viber because I thought that's what I had to do.
Yeah.
And I think I could hear other people doing differently, but I couldn't quite feel it, if that makes any sense.
And I think maybe there's a space where, you know, say it's a close friend. Sometimes you need to tell your friend what you need from them. Like maybe you just need a friend as a hype man or a hype lady where you just go, hey, just make me feel good about this. Give me good advice or just support me. And other times you go, hey, I really need to hear the hard truth about this. And potentially having different people for different things might be useful because it's hard to know what any one person needs out of a relationship or friendship. So, yeah.
Mm, definitely. And I guess what surprised me is that I wasn't really going to them for you know, the hype, the pat on the back. I was like, just tell me how it is. And I didn't really get that. But I know that they were also trying to be kind.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, so what then happened? So I know you got some amazing help from Craig Noonan, who I think I'm just a massive fan of. We've had him on the Anesthesia Coffee Break podcast, and he's been a massive influence in a lot of the ways that I think about the exam on many different levels that, you know, it'd be even hard to explain. But yeah, what was that like?
So a few things happened when I had my second attempt. I had changed jobs and I'd gone to Monash where Craig Noonan works. I was unknown to Monash. And I think that also helped me because I was an unknown entity and people were trying to feel me out. And so I ended up accidentally doing vibers in trying to talk to people about the patients, whereas previously I'd worked at places where I was well known. And I think that people had clinical confidence in me. So no one ever questioned me or challenged me. So I went to a new workplace where I think people wanted to know, you know, does she know her stuff or not? We don't know her. Mm. Craig, I was put in touch with Craig by a good friend who works there as someone who will take people under his wing and help them. You know, he's a well-known educator in the anaesthetic space. There were a couple of other Monash trainees who'd also been unsuccessful. And so together we kind of worked through resitting the exam. Initially, Craig took me to have a coffee to sort of talk about the exam and his approach to resitting it. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be a fascinating conversation because I had gone to meet him with my exam hat on and we sat down and he just started asking me all these random things about my life and what I do and what I like, and you know, it sort of slowly came a conversation about anesthesia, and I remember he put his cup down and stared at me right between the eyes and said, are you good enough to be an anaesthetist? And I was really taken aback because my confidence wasn't very good at the time after failing, and I understand now that he, you know, it was a process of trying to build your confidence back up. Mm. And he wants you to get to the point where you say, yes, I am. Mm. I am good enough to do this.
What did you answer that first question?
I think I kind of ummed and ahed and said, I think so.
I would have said the same. You know, in the time of doing the exam and studying, I really didn't have that much confidence in myself as of how brutal it was. And if someone had asked me that, I was like, look, I think so, but we'll see.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. Like, and I see, so sort of it's part of his process, I think, to say, well, I'm about to invest in you. Are you worth it? Are you good enough? Show me. And I think that's fair. Like, you know, I think you do need to walk into the exam with the confidence to say, I am worthy of joining this club where I get a fan sticker beside my name.
Yeah.
And so there was that part of it. In terms of how things started, I remember he was like, so my ground rules are you come along, you know, you're committed to this process. We'll be doing a couple of sessions a week. There's three of you. We will never meet alone. We always work in at least pairs or all three of you together. I want you to have the confidence to talk in front of other people and defend your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm going to make you talk in front of each other.
That's a good thing. I think you mentioned here, like, you know, rebuild your confidence, be fearless when talking in front of others, and you can only get there by doing it over and over again, because that's what the exam is, not being afraid of your ideas and your the way you manage something.
That's exactly it. Like, you know, you can't shy away from having to make a decision in the exam, and you have to come to a reasonable decision that people will respect and say, yeah, that's safe, even if it's not what they would do.
Yeah. And you mentioned here he said he'd help you see the world or see this exam the way he sees it. I'm not sure. I imagine you'll go into that in a second. Is there more to that?
Yeah. So our first Viva session, he had his cards that I don't know how old they are.
Yep.
Well-loved cards. And he just started firing off questions from his cards at us. And I remember sitting there thinking, I thought you were going to help me with the Viva. You're just reading your cards at me and asking me to talk. This is strange.
Yep.
And it sort of became, you know, a process, I guess. So we started off with these cards, and he sort of said, okay, so here is how I order my thoughts. I use cards. You will use cards now if you have not. You will use them how I use them. And so we talked about how he designed his cards, and he said they have to be the small cards. They're not the big cards. You have a heading, and so you have your topic on there, you give it a definition, and then you write what really matters.
Mm.
And I don't want the card filled with text.
Mm.
The more space, the better. And for the first few sessions, based on the questions or the vibes that we started doing, he gave us homework and would say, all right, so next time I see you, I want a card on this, I want a card on this, I want a card on this, and I will look at them and see if I'm happy with what you've done.
Mm.
And so I do have in my collection of cards, which I still have, a few Craig cards where he has annotated what he would have liked on there.
Yeah.
No offense, Craig, I can't read some of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's funny, I'm such a big fan of cards. Even my whole primary exam is all in like a couple of folders of just those little boxes that store those cards. And then for the second part, the second exam, I ended up having everything online, and I just couldn't remember things. So I ended up transcribing everything from those notes that I had onto cards. And that was a game changer. I started remembering everything simply because I'd done it so many times, but also I think just transcribing it, having that hand to brain connection was really useful. And the only difference is I totally agree. I had a simple definition of something or an intro statement with things that are important. And then I had in micro writing lots of detail. But when I looked at the card, I would just be able to see the headlines. So that was what is most important. The points of difference I talk about are the critical issues that people say. And then if I needed to look into something because I wanted a bit more detail, I wanted to remember a specific number or fact, then I had to look closer and I could see that it was there. But all the little things, like just the fact that it was on paper, the fact that there was a design to it, it was more memorable to have varying designs and blemishes and imperfections than having a perfectly set out Word document on, you know, hundreds of topics.
And I think you know, it's all about getting to the meat of what matters. Like, what are the, you know, like you say, what are the critical issues? And being able to dampen down the noise around that.
I know you mentioned structures and critical issues. And the way I see these interplay is you cannot just say, you know, cliched statements or things like, you know, I'll do my ABCs assessment. But if you're going to do it quickly, but get to the point of difference or the critical issue within a framework, and you can always fall back on the framework for more detail. Is that the way you see it, or is it different to that?
Similar, maybe slightly different. I guess what I kind of realized was that all those, I had documents from so many people, like, these are my structures, these are my opening statements, all this kind of stuff. That the structure is actually meant for you is how I see it. It's your mental prompt. The examiner doesn't want to hear it. that's sort of was my take home message. And that, you know, it's got to be relevant to the patient that you're being presented with. So, you know, I always use the example of, like, you have a trauma and the person's leg is cut off and they are exsanguinating. Yes, the primary survey starts with A, but don't spend all your time telling me that you're looking at A and then B whilst they're hemorrhaging. Like, I think you have to also have the sense and the sort of clinical awareness to say, I will violate this structure right now because that is not what matters, but I recognize it is part of the primary survey and I will, you know, come to that.
I think that's worth highlighting. We're going to have so many guidelines, so many protocols, so many things that you know of, and you have to know those back to front extremely well, but you have to break them. And I think I mentioned a few of my exam sessions how I've seen plenty of times where they make it so that you cannot follow the structure, like the intoxicated patient, you're trying to do a primary survey on an intoxicated patient. No, that doesn't work. You have to, you know, get them restrained in some fashion, physically and chemically, and then get to it later. But know that this is an immediate problem to be solved, even though you've been taught ATLS and EMST.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's an evolution too, though, I think, in learning how to answer these questions, because I think you need to have these sound structures to fall back on for yourself and then learn how to use them to make them an actual tool in the exam rather than pointless statements that the examiner's like, you haven't told me a single thing about this patient. Like, I do struggle to not be negative when people say, I would use an ABCDE approach. I'm like, well, yes, you're talking to an anaesthetist who also knows that approach and you've done nothing.
And that's what the exam doesn't make completely transparent. So that's the game. You've got to know that there's nothing there that is going to separate you from anyone else. And ASCE examiners have probably at this point chosen to not want to hear that because it's the same thing. So it's not saying that's the wrong answer. It's saying it's not the answer they want. And you got to know this.
And likewise, I think I'd add to that you're not doing anything for the patient. One of the important things is, the exam is about you have this problem and you have this patient, and what will you do?
That's good. So some of the tips: making cards, being absolutely brutal about writing down and making these cards, getting to the answer, getting to the point, having a structure that you know, but not necessarily going to any depth about it. Anything else that, and this was regular, this was weekly sessions in front of people. So you're talking out things in front of people. And you're not being shy about it. So you're able to express your ideas. Yeah.
Yes. I think that's
a good summary.
The heart of it. Yeah, definitely.
So how do you now understand the VIVA?
I understand that it is a conversation. You're talking to your peers. You're talking to a colleague. You go into the exam as a FANSCA, thinking you're a FANSCA, and you are talking about challenging cases with a colleague. I think that is actually how you're meant to walk in there feeling. Mm-hmm. And I always sort of add to that, you want to imagine that you're talking to someone a little bit important that you want to impress so that you sound good.
I've definitely thought about this, and I think I've said many things that from everything from, oh, this is definitely not a conversation. This is an interrogation by an examiner and you've got to make sure you pass it. But now that I think I want to modify that a bit, which is, it's almost like you want to have the confidence that you're speaking to someone maybe a little bit junior, but who you also want to impress. And they're very intelligent and inquisitive in a slightly interrogative way. So if you can kind of piece that together, it's someone you want to talk to very well because you don't want, you know, them to think you're dumb, and they're junior. So you can feel a little, just slightly confident in yourself as you're talking to them. And they also are at liberty to constantly ask you clarifications, but in a curious, interested fashion. Does that work for you?
I guess I probably pitched it the other direction, to be honest, as like I'm talking to the director and he knows what I'm talking about and he doesn't want to faff. And because he's my director, I want to sound like I'm really polished and switched on.
Yep.
And because he's the director and I assume knows more than me, will inquire and challenge me on the bits that they want clarification over. So I guess kind of the same idea, but I think I'm heading the other way.
Yep. Maybe I just always want to imagine people are, you know, a certain level.
Maybe I just need to be a little bit more intimidated from behind.
I guess so. Conversation between peers. What else do you take away from this?
I don't think it's worth summarizing the case unless it adds some kind of value to the statement. I think the examiner can read the stem. Mm. They don't need you to reread it for them. Mm. I think it's tempting because I think that the approach of summarizing and signposting can be helpful just to collect your thoughts. But I think if you dedicate too much time to doing that, you don't actually make any progress. You don't manage the patient. You don't make any decisions. And that's what this exam is actually trying to get to the heart of, I think.
I agree. If you don't need to clarify anything for yourself, no need to summarize if it's straightforward. But if it's complicated and you're almost doing it for yourself, I think it's worth just saying, look, just to collect my thoughts, just to get my thoughts into gear, something like that means that you're doing it for your reasons, not for the question. And that feels fair. But if you're summarizing it as if that's the answer the examiner wants, it feels like a bit of a waste of time.
I think so. I think, I started to summarize things that I think were important to provide context to what they were asking. So I do think the ANSCA-VIVAs are quite clever in how they often like to provide some kind of difficult situation or conflict. And I think your summary can be calling that out and saying, this patient is a burns patient and a trauma patient. My resuscitation is complicated by that. Because on one hand, I need to give high-volume crystalloid, but I could be contributing to a dilution of coagulopathy, and that is in direct opposition to hemostatic resuscitation principles. Mm. You know, and that is not what is in the stem, but that is my summary of what I see.
That's adding value to
it. Yeah.
Yeah, good. So let's go to the stem. So how do you, like, what is your system that you would suggest, what Craig suggested for approaching the stems?
I actually don't remember if Craig had a suggestion for how to approach it, but I guess I, you know, was a sponge for taking on people's feedback and I tried lots of different things. And again, for me, it was like, what approach gets the most out of this stem for me? Mm-hmm. So a few things that still resonate with me when I do VIVAs with people, everything that is in the stem is there for a reason. So, you know, pay attention to what they've said. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so don't miss those sort of small details that might be sitting there.
Mm. Why have they mentioned this in a cath lab? Why have they on a methamphetamine use and they're tachycardic, you know, like...
Why is this stent at a bifurcation? You know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's all there. I think one of the other things, I always read the question first because it then frames the way I read the stem.
Yes, I do the same thing. So I, especially because some of the stems are quite long, I think it's really helpful to have a context for what you're reading. Mm. And you know, I tried out a few different approaches to how I would extract information. I used to use the, you know, patient, surgery, anesthesia kind of framework, and I ended up abandoning that for something slightly different, which when I actually say it out loud, it's not that different. But for some reason, for my brain, having it as like patient, procedure, place, and then parent piece. Helped my brain better.
And I found that approach, like, you know, the I think I've added another one, personnel, in that, but those for broad situations, if, you know, patient anesthetic surgical doesn't get you all the way there, but, you know, place, pathology, procedure, personnel, pathology, yeah, these really do get you there.
And another thing I realized as well for pediatric vivas is in my first sitting, there was a pediatric viva where there was no patient weight given. And, you know, under the stress of the exam, I wasn't really that structured in how I approached the stem. So for all peds vivas, if they haven't got a weight, I always write their estimated weight. And then I do a little table with A, B, C, D, and I put, you know, airway, like what would my airway equipment be? You know, B, what would my tidal volume be? C, what would my emergency, you know, my atropine and my adrenaline doses be? D, what's my defib going to be set at for that weight? And just so that under pressure, when I'm being questioned, I'm not trying to do the maths and I've already thought about it.
Yeah, that's, I think that's an absolutely crucial thing. Yeah, maths under pressure just doesn't go well. And because you've got the stem on the wall that you're reading before you walk in after 2 minutes of reading, then you get to the table and there's usually a stem there, and you can't write on that stem, so you need to be writing. You know, like normally you'd underline things that are important. I'd be writing things that are those peculiarities. Why did they mention that the patient has poor dentition? I'd just write that as a thing because anytime I'm stuck for an answer, I can look down and just try to look at what else is there, and you can always tell the examiner, look, Let me check my notes, you know, or something, just to get you back to where you might, where the answer might be.
For sure.
I think you've also mentioned, we were going through some of your notes and things that you kind of provide for people that you're teaching. So what do you write down? Do you read some of the issues, anything with numbers? So issues, that makes sense. It's whatever you think the critical issues are of this scenario, you can quickly write down. What's your system for stems and any issues? You'll also write those down.
Yes. Yeah. So with, you know, that sort of patient, pathology, procedure, place, peds, and you threw in personnel, I would, you know, take, you know, for each one of those things, you know, write what was relevant from that stem beside it. And then only if I had time, I would actively try to think about answering the question.
Yes.
So that was kind of the last thing I did.
Excellent. I think we've gone through quite a bit there. Now, one of the things you kind of sent me in your notes is what I wish people had explicitly told me not to do. I think we covered a bit of this as well. Actually, just to refresh, so, you know, viva summary, only worthwhile if it adds value. Do not regurgitate structures. Whether it's ABCD approach or history examination investigation, there's a faster way of saying that and getting to actions than what you mentioned, where, you know, you want to be doing things for the patient or adding value to what's already been given. So I think that's really useful and not always obvious. And how about this thing of serving up the red wine first? What's that about?
So that was something that in my first sitting someone had said to me, and I remember not really quite understanding what they meant. And I get it now. It's all about showing the examiner that your clinical acumen is where it should be, I guess. That's how I see it.
Because there's a variation to when someone told me this thing was serve your best red wine first, because say you get dinner guests, you've got a bunch of different red wines. You give your best bottle first, and then they go, ooh, this is a really nice red wine. And as they get more and more inebriated, it doesn't matter what you serve them after that. So you can then serve your cheap wine later, which is kind of like the exam. That first impression is the red wine. The examiner thinks you're an absolute gun. And then later on, you can stuff up a bit and serve your not so great goon wine.
That's right. I'll have the Grange, thanks.
Yeah, the Grange.
So I guess like you can have, there are often questions where it's inviting you to provide a list of differentials. But I think most of the context, like if you've got that patient and that context, you know, solidified, there is one true differential that they want you to discuss. Mm-hmm. A recent example I can think of is, you know, you have neck trauma and evolving subcutaneous emphysema. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tracheal laryngo disruption is, you know, number one. I think, you know, you need to say that is number one, but there could be a whole host of other differentials. Don't bury the important stuff, the most obvious differential amongst the list because you're trying to be too structured.
Yeah. Imagine going through the four H's and four T's of something when really, you know, there's a very specific thing that's just red flagging right at you.
That's right. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's about that prioritization of information. And I guess the thing is, I always saw it as like, this is going to sound silly. I want to bore the examiner. I don't want to say anything controversial. I want to say the things they want to hear. I don't want to give them any visual cues that I'm uncertain. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to be sitting there listening to the same thing being spoken about time and time again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're only human, probably aren't listening to every single word you say. Like you say, you start off with the good stuff and they'll be like, this person's got this. I'm quite happy to quietly stare out the window until you indicate they should be paying attention.
Yep.
Hopefully don't. Don't give them something that grabs their attention.
In the wrong way.
In the wrong way. Don't roll your eyes and groan or like scratch your head a lot or say things that might go, oh, tell me more about that.
Was there a time the examiner asked you, are you sure?
Yep, definitely.
And how did that go? What was that about? I always tell the Viva Boot Camp trainees that, you know, this means a very specific thing, but what are your thoughts on it?
I think I've had, on reflection, I think I've had, are you sure, as a, this is the olive branch, mm-hmm. Because you're not quite telling me what I want to hear, or maybe, you know, you'd like to reconsider your answer. I have also had the are you sure as a, we're baiting you to not stand your ground.
Really? That would be it.
Yes. I had a Viva, and it was a perioperative focus pre-admission clinic-based patient, and they were really challenging your knowledge of the AHA-ACC guidelines, and so they kept baiting you to request additional cardiac testing. Mm-hmm. And so, and in that patient, none of it was indicated.
Yep.
But I got like that. So you now know that they have left ventricular hypertrophy on their ECG. Do you want an echo now? And I said, no, because their mets are greater than four.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Are you sure? Yes, I'm sure. Great. Moving on.
Oh, that seems a bit unfair, I've got to say. You've given an answer in good faith. And they go, oh, well, I'm gonna test you to see if you like that feels weird.
Yes.
I would say that there's a difference. If you say an answer with an inflection on your voice, yes, and if you sound unsure, then I'd genuinely ask, are you sure? But if you said a straight answer,
Right. Sorry, I used to think that it was the, oh, I should reevaluate my answer, but
not always.
Not always. So I think you have to be savvy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned a few things here about the uncomfortable things can often make you better. Tell us about that.
I guess that's more about feedback. Mm-hmm. And I guess the self-reflection side of things. And I say that because in hindsight, I knew that I was not doing well at the Viva the first time I sat. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's an uncomfortable truth to say, I know that I am underperforming. But I suppose I also didn't know what to do about it.
Yeah. Just in one of the slides that you sent me, Michelle, you talk about Viva with an audience more often than not, videoing yourself and also revisiting Vivas. I guess these are the kind of uncomfortable things. How did you arrange that? What was that like?
So I guess the, you know, having an audience, Craig sort of forced upon me. Mm-hmm. I remember being very kind of quiet and hesitant in my first sitting, actually, when I sat the Vivas. Mm-hmm. And I think having an audience beat that out of me, because you get used to just talking in front of other people, it becomes a nothing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's very uncomfortable when you are not feeling very confident to, you know, talk out loud and be trying to defend things that you're saying you've decided to do, which may not be what someone else has decided to do either.
Yep.
So there's that side of it. I kind of speaking to what I was saying before about indicating to the examiner your uncertainty, I did video myself a lot. And when I first started, it was horrible. I hated doing it, and I could barely bring myself to watch it. But the more I did it, the more I didn't care. Like all things, you normalize it and then it doesn't matter anymore. And it was really useful because I could hear the phrases I was using, hear how my voice sounded, look at my mannerisms to see if I was indicating uncertainty or doing weird things. I noticed that when I wasn't confident, I would kind of look up in the air like I was thinking. And I trained myself to stop doing that because I didn't want the examiners to see my uncertainty. Mm. And I think that is part of the game.
Yeah.
But it was really uncomfortable filming myself and really uncomfortable to watch at first.
It's like a must-do activity. If you're going to do this Viva, if you're struggling with it, absolutely do this.
You've got nothing to lose. Mm. And we all have a phone with a camera. I remember I had my son asleep in the car and I was like, okay, I am going to sit here and talk through crises. And so I sat there, filmed myself. I had, you know, a list on my phone of crises, and I was like, okay, intraoperative bronchospasm, go. Filmed it, watched it, thought, no, I don't like how I said that. No, that's rubbish, don't say that. No, that's wrong, don't say that. And just did it again.
Chef, I find that time in the car just really valuable, like whether you're listening to a podcast like this or just rehearsing things. Like, I'm in the car, I turn off the radio, and I just run through things. And that's helped me so much. I remember doing that for a couple of recent interviews that I had and a couple of speeches that I had to make. And I thought, you know what, that was the best 15, 30 minutes of just running through things just to get the words out. I think that was really useful.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got to be smart with your time as well. Mm-hmm. And why not use that time effectively and also, you know, get the most, you know, improvement out of it.
Oh, that's really good. So I think we've covered most of the things we want to talk about, really, covering your journey, kind of the things that weren't quite optimal and what you had to do to pretty much redo a lot of the way you study. I think it's obviously just a lot of work, like, you know, the cards and the recording and the weekly sessions, and hopefully that's the kind of level of reset that most people need to get through this exam when they're doing it a second time. Is there anything else you wanted to add, Michelle, before we sign off there?
I guess also to say, like, you know, life goes on when, you know, you have to redo these exams, and it's not an uncommon journey for people. But, you know, I think like all things, if it hasn't gone to plan the first time, it is confronting and challenging to say, I think I need to change what I've done. Mm-hmm. And knowing what that is hard, but I don't see the value in doing the same thing twice.
Yeah.
You know, the hard truth is that you've got to make make some changes and, you know, shake things up.
That's right. And it is a learning curve. Like when you start again, you may have a slight decrease in performance, but it's, you know, just trust the process. Hopefully you got the right advice to redo it and kind of, you know, learn the material and present it in the right way for the second time.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of good people out there who, you know, will dedicate their time to helping with that process.
And just a quick plug. So for the final exam, we've got a course called iXL. So if you visit anesthesiacollective.com, in the courses section, the iXL course was originally for SIMGs who often struggle with the exam, but we've opened it up to anyone who's failed the exam, struggling with the exam as well. And that really pretty much includes a whole learning kind of management platform, as well as weekly Viva sessions with Fanskers. So hopefully, yeah, if anyone's got any trouble, they can reach out to me at abcsofanesthesia@gmail.com. But yeah, thanks so much, Michelle. Just really, really, really appreciate it. I know the baton's kind of been passed on to you in a way. I think a lot of people reach out to you when they've had issues, and I'll definitely try to get you onto one of our sessions with iXL as well. So thanks very much, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you again next time for the next episode.